Hi. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 25th, 1996. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Larry Rasmussen. Today he will be continuing his series on Jubilee and the Sustainable Society. Today's session number is 8 and is titled Jubilee and the Prospects for Sustainability. Let's listen in.
Rasmussen, and the series this week is on Jubilee, the weekly theme, and sustainable society, or as I'm going to talk about it today, a sustainable community. I think Jubilee is a biblical vision of a sustainable society or a sustainable community. We're sort of putting that there as a reference point, but the primary focus of our discussion is how we move from a condition of unsustainability, which we, I think, presently have, certainly if you want to extend living conditions worthy of the name to many more millions of people than presently enjoy them. We've done a couple of sessions on unsustainability, how we've gotten to this point. There's a lot more to say about that, but I did not want to spend the whole week exploring the how we got to unsustainability and then leave all of us wondering at the end of the week where do we go from here. So today's session and tomorrow's session are on the prospects for sustainability and examples of sustainable communities, just as that vision in Leviticus 25 is a vision of a sustainable society or sustainable communities. So we now have a lot of experiments going on around the world that in fact look very promising as examples of sustainable communities and societies. Tomorrow, when we go to those concrete examples, one thing that we can talk about is whether Holden is a sustainable community. I think, Eric, you were the one that mentioned at lunch today that one of the things about Holden is that you see all the infrastructure. I mean, everybody that's on staff's got to be a garbologist, and you live real close to whether or not you got sufficient electricity or not, because the pump is right up the hill. Well, one of the principles of a sustainable community is that everybody knows what they're dependent upon, and their responsibility lies very, very close to the substructure, infrastructure that's providing it. We'll get into that. So let's do that for a while, and then I'll make some presentation, and then we'll have about half the time to learn what the collective wisdom is in the room. I have been pushing a book that I've written on the topic. It's called Earth Community, Earth Ethics. It will be published in October, and if you want information about it, there is a flyer here for you. I suspect that the biggest scientific discovery of the 20th century, in retrospect, will be that nature is a community. That everything really is connected to everything else and has to be understood that way. The big shift in science over the last couple of centuries is from science describing reality in highly kind of mechanistic terms to now science describing reality in relational terms, and an understanding that nature, including us, belongs to a grand community, and if we're to understand how things work, we have to understand how community works. But what do we now do in moving from unsustainability to sustainability if it's true that community on various levels, from the biophysical world, ecosystems, to the local neighborhood, is to be the organizing theme. What are the guideposts? What are the samples? What stakes out the kind of society that we seek? I'll tell you my prejudices at the beginning. You should know them rather than have to try to guess them. The major proposal these days for making for a sustainable society is around the phrase that became the centerpiece at the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro in June 1992. That proposal is called sustainable development. All of the big global conferences sponsored by the United Nations over the past 5 years, Rio Summit on Environment and Development, Cairo Summit on Population and Development, Social Development at the Copenhagen Summit, the Beijing Fourth World Conference on Women, and now the UN Conference on Habitat in Istanbul, have all put at the center sustainable development as the answer to the fact that planetarily we seem stuck in unsustainability. I don't think it's going to work. That's not going to keep anybody from pursuing it, I assure you. I think what we have to talk about as an alternative is sustainable community, and the basic difference is the following. Sustainable development is a scheme which assumes that the global capitalist economy is the centerpiece, and you need to make that environmentally sustainable. It's a qualification of the present economy in terms of its environmental sustainability that sustainable development has at the center. Sustainable community, which I think is more in keeping with both the Jubilee and some important experiments these days, does not assume that the environment gets wrapped around the economy. Sustainable community assumes that both the economy and the environment get wrapped around communities. That is, the question is, what makes for healthy communities? The basic question, not what makes for environmentally qualified global economy. Economics in the capitalist system asks the question, focuses on the production, distribution, and consumption of material goods. Economics in the system focusing on sustainable community says, what do you need to do here in the production of material and distribution of material goods that makes for a healthy community? So that's basically where a contrast that I need to introduce at the outset, because my bias is one which is in favor of sustainable community. All right, what on earth is to be done? How do you move from unsustainability to sustainability? Well, the first thing you do is ask the Danes. It's always the first thing you should do. It's not because my name is Rasmussen. That's not the reason. In 1990, three school children in Kalundborg, Denmark, received an assignment. They were to produce a model in environmental studies showing how the industrial wastes were being exchanged among the local companies in Kalundborg. Now, Kalundborg, Denmark is a small city on the shore of a deep fjord in the Green Belt. It's called the Great Belt. The Great Belt is a body of salt water that connects the Baltic Sea to the North Sea, going right between some of the islands of Denmark. You got a medieval cathedral prominently marks the town center. The streets are otherwise lined with 1, 2, and 3-story buildings of solid colors and the kind of subdued practical affluence that typifies Scandinavia. Kalundborg is a little more industrial than most small cities, but like others, it resides in basically rural surroundings. Now, what these three school kids found was this. If I had been well prepared, I would have given you a diagram. You just have to listen. Don't try to follow the complexity. Just get the general idea. Here's what they found. A coal-fired power plant, an oil refinery, a pharmaceutical company specializing in biotechnology, a sheetrock plant, concrete cement producers, a producer of sulfuric acid, the municipal heating authority, a fish farm, some greenhouses, local farms, and other enterprises had all discovered mutually beneficial ways to trade each other's waste. The ASNES, power plant started the process in the 1980s by recycling its waste heat in the form of steam. Before that, it had condensed the steam and returned it to the fjord that emptied into the Great Belt, thereby warming the salt waters. Now the steam goes to the Stadt Oil refinery and to the Novo Nordisk pharmaceutical company. It also provides surplus heat to greenhouses, to a fish farm owned by the utility, and to town residents. 3,500 oil-burning heat systems in town have been shut off as a result. The Stadt Oil refinery is connected to the Asnes power plant in another way. After the water the refinery pulls into its system from the Great Belt is used as a coolant, it's sent along to Asnes, where it serves as a coolant a second time. Stadt Oil itself produces surplus gas as a consequence of refining oil for petroleum. The gas was not used prior to 1991 because it contained excessive amounts of sulfur. The refinery has since installed a process to remove the sulfur, and the cleaner burning gas is sold rather than burned off like you see in New Jersey. Is sold to Gyprock, the sheetrock factory, as well as to the coal-fired utility plant. That saves 30,000 tons of coal a year. The retrieved sulfur itself is sold to Chimera, a chemical company. At the Asnes power plant, the process that removes the sulfur in the smokestacks also yields calcium sulfate, which in turn is sold to Gyprock, the sheetrock company, as a substitute for mined gypsum. Mm-hmm. Which now can go farther, it doesn't need to be taken out of the ground. Fly ash from coal generation is used for road construction and for concrete production. Waste heat from the refinery is used to warm the waters of a fish farm that now produces 200 tons of turbot and trout annually. The fish grow faster in warmer water. Fish sludge goes to the local farmers as a natural fertilizer. Meanwhile, Novo Nordisk, the pharmaceutical, actually, and some of you may use insulin produced from Novo Nordisk. It's an internationally known creator of insulin and enzymes. They've developed a process to use the 700,000 tons of a thin nitrogen-rich slurry that it previously dumped into the fjord. and now that slurry is pumped free to local farmers who, after the addition of some chalk lime and processing at 9 degrees centigrade for an hour to kill any remaining microorganisms, use it as a fertilizer. Farmers in turn grow biomass, plant mass, for Novo Nordisk's fermentation vats. Yeast cake from the vats goes back to the farmers as food for the hogs. All right, the students just wrote all this down. And then they drew an analogy wiser than they knew. They likened Kallenborg's industrial ecology to food webs in nature. They were correct. Kallenborg had unwittingly heeded the basic earth principle that we talked about yesterday, that waste equals food and habitat in nature. The waste from one process becomes food and habitat for some other creatures. By being a closed system, that's what Kallenborg did. They treated their industries as a single closed system. They imitated nature as a community, because nature is a closed system in which everything contributes some way to further cycles. Robert Frené, who with Paul Hawken reports this case of Kallenborg, quotes the poet George Meredith at this juncture. The poet: "Earth knows no desolation. She smells regeneration in the moist breath of decay." Said differently, nature's own blueprints go beyond linear thinking, and they go beyond cradle to grave thinking. I mentioned yesterday that Germans have legislation now where the automobile manufacturer is responsible for the automobile from the very beginning of the process through recycling it. That's cradle to grave. Nature goes one step further and makes it cradle to cradle. It becomes a beginning of something else, probably not a car. Okay, so the moist breath of desolation smells of regeneration. The students didn't say it exactly that way, but describing nature's food webs is much the same. Well, my point with this example is that sustainability will happen, if it happens, only from careful listening to nature and mimicking some of the basic design strategies of nature. But that begs the real question, as Mark mentioned yesterday, one has to ask, which nature and how is it understood? Because we've got many different understandings of nature, and my proposal is twofold. One, nature as community. And second proposal is ask the Danes. All right, so back to the Danes. The industries of Kallenborg didn't set out to mimic nature. They simply found it beneficial to the interests of everybody to think ecologically. Thinking ecologically means capacity to kind of think around corners, to think sideways, to think in an interconnected way instead of linearly. One thing follows in a strict cause and effect from something else. So they were thinking ecologically about the community, its economic livelihood, its land, its fjord, its sea. And the students, in their momentary fit of genius here, simply showed that the industries and the town were close to nature's way of dealing with its own sustainability. So what Kallenborg then did was kind of half stumbled onto the basic requisite for sustainability, namely understanding creation as a genuine community and aligning human configurations in keeping with that. More precisely, the Danes acted as though nature is a community, whether they understood its detail or not. That's how they thought about it, and that's how they proceeded. So the first requisite for moving toward a sustainable society is a very simple one. Community is nature's way. I put it up on the board. All that exists coexists. Nothing exists by itself. It exists as a complex of changing relationships. We've not really gotten that straight in the West, and since the Industrial Revolution, as I've mentioned probably ad nauseum by now, we've seen ourselves as a species apart, and thus didn't understand how dependent we indeed are. And we have had a real confidence in kind of docetic or ungrounded, kind of denatured reason. And we've combined that with a confidence in really earth-oblivious economic messianism as a transforming power for good. And it's left earth panting for breath, bleeding, exhausted, something like the tailings up here long after the mine is shut down. All right, let's move into this a little bit. When do we start? 3:45. Okay, about 10 more minutes. All that exists coexists. Community rests at the heart of things. The dance of reality is a permanent dance of energy and elements in a vast communitarian chain that embraces, in fact, the whole cosmos. We're consigned to a wonder, to the wonder of a universe whose tapestry is whole. On one level, that's just to recognize the shift in science from describing reality in a mechanistic way to describing it in a relational way. What ought to be our response to that? And I just put a couple of words on the board to connect this theologically to our own faith tradition. We ought to have a kind of sacramental reservation about messing with things. I've become profoundly conservative in this sense of being very hesitant about tearing the fiber of communities apart, because it's a very slow growing fiber. And our present kind of globalizing economy rips communities apart. They're at the disposal of its dynamics. It is not at the disposal of their health. Sacramentum is the Latin for the Greek word mysterion. Mysterion, mystery, doesn't mean incomprehensibility so much as a profundity that surpasses our words for it. Such reservation, with its sense of a kind of comprehensive spiritual union of earthly elements, the sacramental, is a clue for the new kind of science and technology governed by a new kind of economics and politics that we need. That's what I mean by a kind of profound conservatism toward all that makes for life. It's another way of saying this. If we're going to use community in this way, then one thing we have to understand is that there is no clear line between life and not life, life and non-life. Not when the story of the galaxy, the solar system story, the Earth story, the life story, and the human story are all part of the same story. And they are. Let me give you a couple of quick examples, and then I can see that we've got to just move quickly through some principles and then carry on in the form of discussion. Take breathing, for example. It only works because of the one-time furnaces of now-dead stars. If they hadn't done what they did, you wouldn't be here. And you wouldn't be breathing. They're the sources of gases and processes crucial to the essential formation of oxygen. For that matter, all of the atoms in our bodies, with the exception of primordial hydrogen itself, were produced in these explosions of stars, the supernova explosions. The atoms of the first generation of stars were thrown into space and cycled and recycled into new stars, planets, and eventually living creatures. All of us, all creatures, past, present, and future, began in stardust. And we're all kin as stardust. and that evolved then in the transformations of the universe on its long pilgrimage to date. I mean, one scientist quipped that gas, given enough time, becomes people. I mean, now you understand some of your relatives better. let me give you another example of the fact that you cannot draw a strong line between life and not life. Life is dependent on not life. You have to treat it as a community. If, for example, you were to watch the night side of Earth from a satellite's orbit, you'd see more than 100 flashes of lightning per second. If you were to watch pictures taken from a satellite or if you were in a spaceship. They're part of what scientists call the great nutrient cycle of nature. Lightning annually converts more than 3 million metric tons of atmospheric nitrogen to nitrogen dioxide. Forest fires set by the lightning release additional nitrogen. Decomposing plant and animal matter contributes some more nitrogen. Then rain carries the nitrogen back to water and soil, where after it passes through certain microbial stages, is taken up again by the plants and by the animals. On this elaborate journey, nitrogen separates and recombines with hydrogen, oxygen, and carbon as virtually all life forms absorb and use it and pass it along in altered form. There are lots of other intricate cycles within the larger cycles here, but there isn't any way to separate life from not life in this. All is a part of the other. You and I and other creatures live because lightning is a part of nature's nutrient cycle. If lightning weren't alive, you and I wouldn't be either. I don't expect you to be conscious all the time of this dependence. But we've moved to unsustainability because we don't think in terms of the intricate connections of life and non-life in a highly complex way. And we just think nature is malleable. It's just parts. All right, then I think I better skip to some of the proposals for sustainable communities, some of the principles. Since we're in the Northwest, might think of about how the Kwakiutl people did their logging in these forests. They had two kinds of logging. They would sometimes cut a whole tree down. You need a beam or something. They called that killing the tree. The rest of the time they did their logging by what they called begging the tree. They made an incision here on the tree trunk and another one below it at the point, depending on how long they wanted the plank. And then they just put wedges in between these two incisions down the side and took their log off the tree. And it didn't kill the tree, so the tree just kept on growing and they had their logs. They begged the logs so as not to, the tree for the logs. Or you could think of the seventh generation test of the Iroquois Confederacy you ask what will be the consequences of this decision for seven generations hence. Gregory Bateson, the anthropologist, loved to tell a story of an exchange at New College, Oxford. The main hall at New College, I mean, you know, New College in Oxford is built in the 1600s. It was new then, and it's newer than the other colleges, which were 1300 and 1400. Okay. So the oak beams in the refectory were 40 feet long and 2 feet thick. And they eventually suffered now, in the intervening centuries, from dry rot. And there were not oaks large enough in the immediate neighborhood to replace them. At least they weren't known to the college administrator. So it was suggested to the administrator that he inquire with a college forester whether some of the lands that had been given to Oxford over the years might have trees adequate for the renovation of the refectory. And the forester replied, we've been wondering when you'd ask that question. When the present building was constructed 350 years ago, the architect specified that a grove of oaks be planted and maintained to replace the beams in the ceiling when they suffered from dry rot. And Bateson says, now that's the way to run a culture. Now, ask what seven generations hence will do with the action you're about to undertake. Okay, I will finish here with 17 sensible steps to sustainable community as presented by Wendell Berry. Now, Wendell Berry is talking about a rural environment, but the example of Kalundborg, Denmark, is one in which works for an urban environment as well, and you just have to modify the questions a little bit. So, 17 sensible steps. One, ask of any proposed change or innovation, what will this do to our community? How will this affect our common wealth? Two, include local nature, the land, the water, the air, the native creatures within the membership of the community. They're active agents in all of this. They're interacting with you. Somehow they have to be represented. Three, ask how local needs might be supplied from local sources, including the mutual help of neighbors. When I go get, we've got two fruit stands, fruit and vegetable stands that are open 24 hours a day, 365 days a year in my neighborhood, and I go to get strawberries from there, I'll likely have strawberries from California, not New Jersey or Long Island, and that's not local products. The average miles on a plate of food for America that your food traveled is 1,500. Can you imagine what that does in terms of use of energy, etc.? All right. Supply local needs first, and only then think of exporting products, first to nearby cities and then to others. Five, understand the ultimate unsoundness of the industrial doctrine of labor saving, if that implies poor work, unemployment, or any kind of pollution or contamination. Six, develop properly scaled value-adding industries for local products in order not to become merely a colony of the national or the global economy. Seven, develop small-scale industries and businesses to support the local farm or forestry economy. Eight, strive to produce as much of your own energy as possible. Nine, strive to increase earnings in whatever form within the community and decrease expenditures outside the community. 10, circulate money within the local economy for as long as possible before paying it out. See how many times it can go around in the community. 11, invest in the community to maintain its properties, keep it clean without dirtying some other place. Care for its old people and teach its children. 12, arrange for the old and the young to take care of one another, eliminating institutionalized child care and homes for the aged. The young must learn from the old, not necessarily and not always in school. The community knows and remembers itself by the association of the old and the young. 13, account for the costs that are now conventionally hidden or externalized. Whenever possible, they must be debited from monetary income. Make your infrastructure visible, is the way we talk about it at Holden. 14, look into the possible uses of local currency, community-funded loan programs, systems of barter, and the like. 15, be aware of the economic value of labor, neighborliness as help, insurance, and so on. We must realize that in our time, the costs of living are greatly increased by the loss of neighborhood, leaving people to face their calamities alone. 16. Be acquainted with and complexly connected with community-minded people in nearby towns and cities. And so you have a notion of a region that operates in this space and not just a local neighborhood community. 17. Cultivate urban consumers loyal to local products to build a sustainable rural economy, which will always be more cooperative than competitive. Okay, that's Barry's notion of where you start. We could talk more about some of the principles. The ones I've put on the board up here, I'll just read, and then we'll go to discussion, and tomorrow we'll go to examples of these. Some of these general principles for designing a sustainable community in keeping with nature are as follows. Solutions grow from place. What does nature permit in a given locale? What is compatible with its life? What does nature help us do so that we don't have to arrange an artificial environment? Use wetlands to clean the water instead of building a huge water treatment system. What does nature help us to do? You gotta know your neighborhood. Without the details, nothing can be known, not a lily or a child, writes Diane Ackerman. So solutions grow from place. Get rooted. Okay, secondly, ecological accounting informs design. Just as a full accounting of economic costs is a matter of conventional design, increasingly now, so a full accounting of ecological costs needs to be a part of our production and consumption of things. From resource depletion to pollution and habitat destruction, disposal and reuse. Thirdly, design should be done with nature, what we talked about earlier as cradle-to-cradle design. Fourthly, everyone is a designer. Good designs grow and evolve organically out of a process of communication that includes lots of participation. Everybody gets in on this. You use the collective wisdom of people who know the place. Fifthly, nature should be made visible. One of the books in ecological design is written by Van der Rijn and Cohen, and what they call flush and forget technologies, that's the kind we have, flush and forget technologies, do not build a sense of responsibility or nurture earth-oriented mindfulness. You got to keep biological and other consequences of our action in view and experiencing how they act upon us at shorter rather than longer ranges. That's what fosters responsibility and accountability. All right, I'm just going to stop there now. Otherwise, we'll not have any discussion time. The other things up on the board are what I'm calling norms for sustainable community. But maybe we can get into that when we talk tomorrow about some of the successful examples. What is it that you want to pick up or a challenge, or you can't leave it out now, but okay, Peter.
How can we intelligently hear the input on this healthy community from the critters and the water and the air? I mean, we need to become wiser so we can speak for them, but if this is the community meeting and we're deciding the design of something, someone needs to speak for them.
Yeah, there may be, you know, folks in the room who know sufficiently well about how things have worked in nature, in this community. I mean, I grew up in a farm community where there was a whole lot of collective wisdom among the farmers about what the soil apparently needed, etc. But if you don't have it, then you got to get it. I mean, that just means it needs to be part of the community decision. Who is it that we've got to talk to that can tell us what this forest, how this kind of forest operates, and what its needs are. I mean, last week we happened to have a forest ecologist here that was very, very helpful in saying what Holden needed to do. That's a short answer. If it isn't in the community, then it's a community. It needs to be a community decision to secure that kind of knowledge. Yeah.
Kalundborg, Denmark, I don't know how large it is, but have any similar things you said go to Denmark.
And, yeah.
but I live in St. Paul.
No. And I did ask the Danes.
Yeah. And so I'm just wondering, you know, we have industry, and you live in Manhattan, but yeah. I'm thinking how to take some of this and the radicality into where literally millions of people live. And one of the challenges we talk about in our synod is neighborhood sustainability. Uh-huh. But I think you're thinking of it in a much more comprehensive way. And I'm just wondering if, like Kalundborg, if there's anything been done in a metropolitan-wide.
Yes, at two levels. One is that, and this one doesn't answer your question immediately, in the design of new communities, there's quite a lot being done now in keeping with what is called ecological design. And I'll give an example tomorrow of a new community in Virginia that spent a whole lot of time understanding the ecosystems in which it was evolved, and now they're going to create the treatment of sewage, et cetera, through a wetland system, et cetera, that they're designing. And we'll get into some of that. Hamburg, Germany has done some of that in a major metropolitan area on the edges of Hamburg. But let me give you another example. This happens to also be from Scandinavia. There's a group in Sweden called the Natural Step, and it's trying to do it both regionally and nationally at the same time. What they've done, this group in Sweden has organized 49 local governments and the Swedish Farmers Federation and 22 major Swedish corporations and some 10,000 professionals and business executives and farmers and restaurateurs and students and government officials, and they put them together in 16 networks that cover the country. And they're using that networking to create a model of sustainability for the whole nation. Things like, how do we achieve 100% recycling of metals? How do we eliminate compounds that do not break down naturally in our environment? How do we maintain biological diversity across Sweden? And how do we reduce energy cycles to as close as possible to those that the sun provides? So the Swedes, they're organizing this. Canada has a very interesting system going now called the Canadian Roundtable, in which on a provincial level, what would be a state level equivalent for us, they get, in this case, they're going for the elite. They get the leadership elements of business, the leadership elements of government, the leadership elements of the academy, of academe, and the leadership elements of the non-governmental organizations together. And they have what they call the Canadian Roundtable. And then the Canadian Roundtable, they meet on a regular basis, and these leadership elements do not represent the organizations from which they come. They come as interested individuals addressing a provincial issue, like energy in Manitoba, or traffic problems, something like that. And they talk with one another until they arrive at proposals for the province as individuals. Then they make a commitment to one another to work in their respective constituencies, in corporations, in government, in the NGOs, in the academy, solution. So, and everybody says, everybody else benefits. So the lawmakers say, When I take this to Parliament then and introduce it as a proposal, the other parliamentarian says, you know, where's your support for this? Hey, well, I've got business, I've got the academy, I've got the NGOs behind it. Each of them does that in turn. But by removing, by making them all stakeholders, but by removing their, they don't have to defend their corporation and argue, negotiate on those terms. That's another kind of example. Yeah.
Seems to me market forces are also entering into this.
Yeah.
It costs more to dispose of a cubic yard of concrete in Seattle than it costs to buy a new one.
Yeah.
So they're encouraging reuse of material.
Yes.
I think we see that in garbage all over.
Yeah. What's like I mentioned with this one principle of incorporating ecological design into, I mean, costs into the price. One of the major ways in which you can take the present kind of economy and make it work for you is simply getting the price right. What does it cost to take this from its place in nature, use it, and then return it, and incorporate all of that into the cost? One of the ironies of capitalism is that it's a system which said that it doesn't tolerate free riders and doesn't tolerate a free lunch. But in fact, it has treated nature as exactly that. However, with its own ways of determining market price could include those costs by getting the price right. And if you did that, then you'd see a shift in what is efficient and what is not efficient. And you would end up just making a huge contribution to what people in economics call eco-efficiency. That's kind of some of the legislation that's happening, not only in neighborhoods but also nationally. Yeah.
About the Danish example, you seem to suggest that they sort of backed into the arrangement that they were working with, in a sense that they were looking for an economically efficient way to solve the problem, and luckily because they had open communication between their industries beyond their perhaps more conventional arrangements. They were able to find solutions in others.
Yeah.
Do you are you aware of examples or sort of strategies that are being developed for that sort of cross-industrial communication, so people can become more aware of that, rather than kind of going back to the mine where they might have been getting their sources for years and years before, or things like that?
Well, first of all, just to underscore what you said, because it's very important, it was an appeal to their own self-interest. I mean, it fit the very motivation that comes with the kind of production. So that's how they backed into it. It turned out to be a better way to deal with their ways. Yeah, there are other examples. There are a number of places in Germany now where the production of energy and the use, and then where you've got steam or water, hot water, as the outcome of producing your energy is used locally for heating households or for other industrial plants, etc. And so the cogeneration system is becoming quite widely used, where you don't just think linearly of one product and how do you do that, but you say, how does this work in a web?
Does that suggest sort of the strong argument away from the almost kind of cult value of the market mechanism, that the market will give you will set you up in sort of the linear structure that we found ourselves with, where a more political or a more human-oriented form of networking allows us to operate in much more broad terms. The way, for example, you mentioned in Canada, where very disparate industries can come together and all of a sudden can find common ground where the market mechanism may never make a connection for them.
Yeah. it combines that kind of open communication and where can we benefit by cooperation with market incentives for production. I mean, it is a serious modification, but it doesn't say we got to get rid of markets and substitute command economy. It rejects that. So it's a use of markets within a wider cooperative scheme. Yeah. Was there a hand? Yeah, please.
Yeah, I guess I was. You know, it seems to me that a lot of times people are very attached to permanence. They want to have everything last forever. You know, we use chemicals in our wood to make our houses last forever. And you know, even with the treatment of sewage in a marshland, you know, someday that's going to fill up and it's going to have a new use. And you know, I have a feeling a lot of times people figure that's going to be there forever. And you know, it seems like people should work with the changes of nature and maybe not pay so much attention to permanence.
Yeah.
I'd like to follow up on that and ask whether or not we're idealizing permanence of communities a little too much, and that perhaps a truly sustainable idea about community would take into account how they're born and how they die natural deaths.
Yeah. And yes, the kind of dynamism that's also present in nature, they have like some kind of sense of how that's also present for communities. I also want to say, with respect to this, by community, I don't mean simply localism. And that's why I started by saying that I think the biggest discovery of science in the 20th century is that nature is a community as a whole. And the principle that I'm really pushing here, and we didn't take time to underscore it, is a principle from Christian ethics of subsidiarity. And it goes like this. I'm going to quote a papal document just to show we're ecumenical here at Holden Village. Just as it is gravely wrong to take from individuals what they can accomplish by their own initiative and industry and give it to the community, so also it is an injustice and at the same time a grave evil and disturbance of right order to assign a greater and higher association, to assign to a greater and higher association what lesser and subordinate organizations can do. Now, translating the Pope, this means that what can be accomplished on a smaller scale at close range by high participation with available resources should not be given over to or allowed to be taken over by distant and more and larger organizations. If you can do it with the resources at hand, do it that way. Don't transfer to supposedly higher and larger collectivities what can be provided and performed by allegedly subordinate and lesser ones. But the key here in subsidiarity is not localism, it's what is appropriate action and the appropriate level. For sustainable community, that may mean, in fact, actions, policies, and institutions that are more global than the ones we have. Rectifying ozone damage is not going to happen by nations individually doing it. It's not big enough. They're going to have to agree to cooperate with some larger, more comprehensive authority. Reducing greenhouse gases can't be left to just local communities. That's not the appropriate level. Massive waves of refugees that we're getting more and more now, the curve on refugees and internally displaced persons is going like that. Dealing with that, resulting from conditions of kind of overshoot in their own communities, requires a broader response than local resources can provide. The protection of marine ecosystems and fish populations isn't going to be done by Holden Village, Chelan, or even the state of Washington, even though it's important. Yeah. So with oceans and genetic diversity and climate and ozone layer and even forests and other great concentrations of green matter, but you have to treat it as a global commons. And that requires, on the principle of subsidiarity, some things that have to be more global than others. But on the other hand, a whole lot of other things can be taken care of in smaller organizations. One of the ironies is that the nation state now is too large to take care of a lot of local problems effectively, and too small to take care of a lot of global ones. Yeah. And subsidiarity is a principle for asking what is the appropriate level. And at each point you ask, you start with what can be done with the individuals, the communities, and so on up the ladder.
How do you rectify the differences when one set of experts say this is what should be done, and another set says,
yeah,
no, you're wrong, this is what should be done, and you do that on a global scale?
Good question, because you are going to have different sets.
We do
of,
now.
Of recommendations, and so I don't have a good answer to that. Maybe you've got some things in mind. I think it is important to understand that expertise exists at different levels. And so there expertise that's coming from a group of people who are professionals with this particular problem is it, that's important information. But for a community to handle it, it probably has to interact with some other important information and for a sustainable community. And so one thing that's highly important is getting the different expertises, the different interests themselves, together to see what can happen and the participation therein. I was going to give you an example from Tacoma, Washington. Under the Environmental Protection Agency of the U.S. government, when it was under the leadership of Williams Ruckelshaus in the Nixon administration, and under the Clean Air Act of 1970, the EPA had the authority to decide the fate of a smelting plant in Tacoma. Some of this copper went there. That smelting plant was both a major polluter in Tacoma and a major employer. Annual payroll of $23 million. The issues were thus jobs, the local economy, and health. Ruckelshaus had the authority in the EPA to make a decision about the closing or retaining or keeping the plant open in Washington. Could have made it there. He didn't. He brought the problem and the decision to Tacoma. And there, instead of only setting up the required public hearings, he and other officials initiated a series of public workshops. These public workshops included plant workers, union representatives, various other local citizens and environmental groups. The same format was used for all of the public meetings. It included education about plant emissions. It included incidences of disease in the community. It included local economic implications of various courses of action, and so on, until as well as prepared testimony and open deliberation. And what the community eventually decided wasn't on the minds of Ruckelshaus or the EPA officials or the citizens themselves when the process started. None of them had that solution that they all came to in the end. What they decided in the end was that Tacoma's economy needed to diversify, and that there were ways that they could do that together, ways that included retraining the plant workers. So then they started scheming on how to diversify the economy, retrain workers, etc., and close the smelting plant down. Well, that was an instance where the expertise from Washington would have been the basis for one kind of decision, but it was placed beside the expertise from other groups with other interests, and there was a process of deliberation whereby all of them became sort of experts of one another's expertise and proceeded in that fashion. I don't want to minimize tough decisions here, but high levels of participation in major decision making is one of the principles of, I think, sustainable community. Time is up, folks. Tomorrow I want to pass along a series of examples, and that's another way of also continuing what makes for a sustainable community, and maybe we can get to some of these norms that we've kind of gleaned from these examples of what sufficiency, equity, accountability, material simplicity, spiritual richness, responsibility, and subsidiarity mean. Okay, thank you.